The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Here's where we are. We had begun looking at the passage in Ephesians 1 with the correlative passages in Romans and 2 Timothy, that, and particularly looking at the passage within the framework of the planned character of salvation, the decree of salvation, the salvation as decreed. And we were beginning to look at the passages, particularly the Ephesians passage, in terms of simply establishing how the plan or the category of the will of God is so dominant in this passage. And we want to go on now, having accented that point in a preliminary way, just to show how that is the case here in this passage, the way that comes through in different dimensions, just to be impressed with that. Does that have some decipherability in the back? Not at all, huh? Can't see a thing. I won't. Further comment is unnecessary. We have not only simple references, repeated references to the will of God, but that reference to the will is qualified. We are told, for instance, in verse 5, that it is, what is involved is the eudokeion, the eudokia of the divine will. Now that term, eudokia, here in the accusative case, that can be rendered in two distinct senses that we should remain open to here. It can be understood in the sense of, as it's often rendered in English, good pleasure. The good pleasure of his will, accenting that the will then embodies what is actually God's desire, what pleases him, that God's will is inherently pleasurable to him. So in that sense, the thought reflects back on the God's involvement, as it were. Or alternatively, it can have a sense directed more toward the objects of that will that are in view here, in the sense that it specifies the kind intention of the will. The welfare that is intended for the objects. And more specifically, it's the kindness of salvation, it's saving kindness, we can say, is surely the quality that's picked up from the context. So those are the options here that we should remain, probably not try to press one or the other in a absolutely certain fashion. Good pleasure or kind intention. Or again, we're told, reference is made, verse 9 now, to the mystery of his will. The mystery, to mysterion. The reference to mystery, without exploring the pattern of biblical usage, we'll get into that, those of us in Acts and Paul, in much greater depth. Let's just simply say here that what this does now is accent the sovereignty of the will is given accent here. The thought is that God's will is hidden with him, and that will is inaccessible apart from what Paul will refer to elsewhere as the revelation of the mystery. The revelation of the mystery. That's the language used in Romans 16, 25 and 26, and Colossians 1, 26. So the sovereignty of the will is accented here. Or yet another expression that we encounter, to thelematos, you can see these all have the reference to God's will in the genitive, is here in verse 11, the boule of his will. Boule, we could render that here, a counsel, the S-E-L kind of counsel. If we had to choose one word to render, probably that would be best here, counsel. But we in fact have a word that is substantially overlapping semantically with thelema. So it probably is here particularly a redundant kind of expression, and in fact will suggest there's even more intended redundancy here. But what we can say that this combination does is accent the purposefulness. It underlines the resolve, if you will, the determinedness of God's will. God is quite determined in his will. Or we could even translate, you couldn't argue here against translating this expression, the will of the will, according to the will of his will. Now as well here in the immediate context, there are, in addition to these expressions, other expressions closely correlative, having a redundant effect. For instance, we're told, verse 4, that the divine activity in view here, the divine activity associated with the will, is a choosing activity, even as he has chosen us. Chosen us. Verse 5, then, we're told immediately that that choosing is more specifically a predestinating. A predestinating. Should probably be underlining these in red. A predestinating activity. And that comes out again, the reference to predestination in verse 11. And there's the reference, of course, in Romans 8, 29 and 30. Further, verse 11 not only speaks of the predestinating activity of God, but says that that is according kataprosthen, according to his plan or purpose. So here we have another noun very close in meaning to thelema, the plan or purpose. And verse 9, related to this noun then, speaks of a purposing which is according to his kind intention or good pleasure. That God purposes according to his eudokia. So you can see how, I'm taking a little time here to do this, just to highlight this point, how emphatic the emphasis is here. And in fact, now we can come back and look at verse 11, the way in which things are really just heaped up in that statement, where he tells us that God's predestining activity is according to the plan or purpose of the one who works all things according to the counsel of his will. Or as we've already tried to show, since there's such a slight difference in these terms, it's a matter of nuance. Given the semantic overlap, we can say he wills in advance according to the will of the one who works all things according to the will of his will. You see, it's as if Paul then is wishing to bring us to the point where we say enough already. We see the point. Salvation is of the Lord. Salvation is of the Lord most emphatically, most redundantly emphatically. Salvation is by divine plan in the sense that it is a matter of God's will. By the way, maybe we should just, at least I have in my comments, have been assuming something that I think really has to be, doesn't really need to be argued, but maybe should just be made explicit. That salvation is what is involved here. That salvation is what is purposed and what is the concern of the divine will. Is indicated in various ways. We can note quickly, I don't think there's anyone who would really want to call that into question. What's involved here, for instance, verse 3, is a matter of spiritual blessing. Spiritual blessing. We'll talk about that a little bit further on. Or again, verse 7, it's in view of the will concerns the redemption through His, Christ's blood. And then immediately that redemption is glossed as the forgiveness of sins, the forgiveness of transgressions. Or again, there's the reference in verse 11, probably in this verb to inheritance, and certainly in verse 14, the Spirit as the down payment of inheritance. And there's the reference to the Holy Spirit in verse 13, or more formally stated, but capturing the essence, the gospel of your salvation. That's what the will in view here is all about. The gospel of your salvation. So, we can, I think, rest then at that point. The plan character of salvation is clear enough here. Now, correlative to that, we want to go on and pull out, underline certain dimensions further of this plan. Let's give now more attention to the, if you want to put it real formally, the eternality. That's what that's supposed to spell there. The eternality or the eternal character of the plan. So the question we could raise here is this. Where are we to locate? It's the same question that we posed when we began looking at the passages in Acts. Where are we to locate the thelema, the plan and will of God? Where are we to locate that relative to history? In other words, let me play around with colors here. This pro in the pro orizo, the pro in the pro tithemi, or where's the other one here? The prothesin. How more precisely ought we to understand the reference of that prepositional prefix? And I think we have a very decisive answer to that question here in Ephesians. Decisive particularly in what is the exegetical parallel that we see between verses 4 and 5. Everybody knows what an exegetical parallel is, right? The one serving to interpret the other. What verse 4 speaks of is an action of God in choosing us to be holy and blameless before Him. And that is, when I talk of a parallel then, an explanatory or exegetical, an exegeting, a parallel that serves to exegete or explain, the parallel, what is said there in verse 4 as to the action of God in choosing us to be holy and blameless, that parallels the notion that we have, what we have in verse 5, the action of God in predestinating for adoption. Predestinating for adoption. Those ideas are surely parallel. And verse 4, you see, is very clear. It's expressly said there that this choice, this predestination, is pro katabales kosmu, before the foundation of the world. That is prior to creation, antecedent to creation and its existence. And it is in that sense that we must understand ourselves to be speaking when we say that God's plan, His will, including His electing purpose, it's in that sense of before the creation, antecedent creation, that is an eternal purpose. It is set from eternity. There are other expressions in Paul that we could maybe just quickly remind ourselves here. In Ephesians 3:11, a little bit later on, Paul there speaks of God's prothesis and says that it is ton ionion, or ton ionon. His eternal purpose is the most likely way we should translate that. That's in Ephesians 3:11. Or in our correlative expression, verse 2 Timothy 1:9, 2 Timothy 1:9 says of, well, let's read that again. 2 Timothy 1:9 speaks of God as the one who has called, who has saved us and called us with a holy calling, not according to our works, but according to His own prothesis, kai charon. Literally, His purpose and grace, which we can, I think, see that as kind of Hendiades, we could render it then as His purposed grace, or His gracious purpose. Grace in view here as purposed, at any rate. And Paul says that is granted, that grace given to us, is given to us in Christ Jesus, pro chronon ionion, before time's eternal. Or as the NIV translates there, you see, before the beginning of time. Before the beginning of time. And similarly, without turning there, 1 Corinthians 2:7, Paul speaks there of the wisdom of God. That's the central theme in that passage, in that context. And he says of the wisdom of God, that is wisdom predestined pro ton ionon, before time began, as the NIV translates. So plainly then, from these passages, we must recognize when we speak of the plan of salvation, the planned character of salvation, that plan is eternal in the sense of being pretemporal, with all the mystery and the questions that can come up here as to how divine eternity relates to our sense of time and so on. It must be described, though, as a plan, a purpose that is set before the creation exists. So to add just a couple of notes to that primary thrust here. What comes out in this passage, especially here in verse 4, is the electing thrust, or the electing aspect of God's purpose. What Paul wishes to highlight, particularly in this passage, is election as an aspect of this eternal will. Election, then, to make a point negatively now, and to distance ourselves from a conception that seems to be making itself finding expression more and more these days. Election, though, is not what takes place in the now of the moment of preaching the gospel. Election is not what takes place at the time the gospel call goes out. So to put it another way, election must not be thought of as the eternal depth dimension of this moment, this now in which the gospel is preached. As if before that moment, I think this is a notion we have to guard against, as if before that moment, before that gospel call goes out and is responded to, God was up to that time still undecided. God had yet until that moment to make up his mind, as it were. That can provide us that conception which I'm saying we must reject here, with a rather dramatic and dynamic understanding of what is happening in preaching, but it in fact overrides what the scriptures teach. Romans 8:30, in addition to this passage, affirms in the sequence that the apostle is concerned to maintain there the antecedents, the eternal antecedents of election to proclamation, to historical, to the call that goes out in history. Those he predestined, he also called. A second point here, looking in a somewhat different direction. These are kind of footnotes under this second point. Repeatedly here in the passage, the objects of God's eternal choosing are referred to as us, hemas, we, hemes. I won't take the time here to go through and underline them. You can see that at any number of points. And here we need to be clear. The point is sometimes made, and this is a point that is especially asserted in the issues that surround the difference between Calvinism and Arminianism. An Arminian point, then, is sometimes made that what we have here is this, in this we, is a plural that points us to the corporate concern that Paul has here. That the reference is to the church as a corporate entity, some would want to argue. A corporate entity entirely, and that is in the interests of the Arminian project, we can say. And the further conclusion drawn then is that the predestination in view here is to the church as a corporate entity. But that we're told really nothing here about individuals, about individual believers, and what is the case with individuals in the church. So the point on this approach to the passage is that it does teach unconditional election, but that unconditional election is corporate, not individual. That it is corporate, not personal. Now, to respond to that proposal, which at a first hearing glance can appear to have perhaps considerable plausibility, I think what we have to appreciate, so far as the terms of this passage are concerned, that the proposal reflects, if I could put it this way, a divide and conquer strategy. Because it pulls apart what obviously is to be held together in this passage. To separate in this passage between corporate and individual, as if the reference is to the corporate only and not to the individual, that simply injects a disjunction which has to be rejected as a false disjunction. To polarize here, or to set up as options between which we have to choose between corporate and individual, that, use the word again, that is a disjunction for which there is no evidence in the passage, and in fact, to put it more emphatically, every indication is against such a disjunction. Consider this. The we, the hemes, in this passage, is not only a passive recipient, but it is an active respondent. For instance, verse 12, it is said of the we, or the we are described as those who have hoped, have previously or already hoped in Christ. And again, here it's not a we, but a you. The we, you, are those who, having heard the word of truth, they have believed it. The you have believed the gospel. So what is predicated here, the activity indicated, attributed to the plural, the we, the you, is faith and hope. And what we're bound to consider here is that these are not actions, faith and hope. They are not actions of a corporate entity in distinction from individuals. But these are activities, faith and hope. Manifestly, they are activities of individuals. Now, certainly only in their corporate identity, but they are specific, strictly speaking, individual acts. So we must not, it's not an either or, in other words, but it's a both and, with the individual dimension underlying. Let me just round off a thought here and I'll pick up a question. Similarly, in Romans 8, 28 through 30, that what I'm going to say will not get us, I don't believe, off track here. What Paul there speaks of those who are foreknown and predestined, those who are called according to God's purpose. That's election. He says of those that as such, they are those who love God. Those who love Him are those foreknown and predestined and called. And loving is not the action of an undifferentiated, unindividuated, impersonal entity. But it is those loving individuals, persons. So the point here we're wanting to underline is that election, sovereign, predetermined election, is individual and personal as well as corporate. It is corporate, but it is individual, personal as well. Yes, Kevin. Yeah, I don't think you want to talk about them. I think it would not be helpful to talk about them actually believing before the foundation of the world. It's kind of like our point a little earlier about the lamb slain before the foundation, that's strictly speaking a misleading way of putting things.
It's one thing to do here that they would believe.
Yes.
Faith
is what is effectively determined before the foundation of the world. I think you can put it that way. And I think that that will come out. See, it's not just a matter of faith being foreseen, but faith being eternally effected. With the qualifications of our interchange here. But I did want to go on directly now, having stressed the eternality, to say something as to the sovereignty of the plan. It's a closely related point. The question we're raising here is this. Is there any factor outside of God that determines salvation? Is there any factor not included in God's plan that affects salvation? And I don't think it overstates to put it this way. To ask that question to ask it in the light of what we've already been seeing in our preceding discussion is already to be at an answer. And that answer is a negative answer. No, there is nothing. There's nothing that falls outside of God's determining plan. It is an all-determining plan. Let me spell that out, pursue that further in the passage. There is simply no place in the passage for the notion that salvation would be constituted by some element lying outside of the scope and control of God's counsel. Saying nothing, no indication in the passage, nothing that could be taken as indicating that salvation will be brought about, be affected in some way by some factor lying outside of the controlling scope of the divine will. Remember what we were giving the time to put such emphasis on, that sustained, redundant emphasis on the will as God's will. That kind of emphasis simply excludes that the will of man would somehow be co-determinant or co-determinant in salvation. Whether you would understand that exercise of will as faith or some other function. I'm saying the sustained emphasis here in the passage on God's will, the mystery of that will, the will as all-comprehending, excludes that somehow the will of man would come into the picture as correlative or co-determinant in salvation. As Professor Murray puts it here, worth quoting, to think otherwise is, quote, to trifle with the plain import of the term. To trifle with the plain import of the terms. That's on page 127 of Collected Writings, Volume 2. There is certainly, we can say, no indication, no positive indication here of any such co-qualifying or determining factor. It's not simply a matter here of basing on silence what's not said. We can reinforce this point focusing in again on that notion of the divine eudokia, the good pleasure, the kind intention of God, whether we understand it as desire or intention. God's saving purpose arises solely from his own eudokia. It is not shaped, it is not determined by any other eudokia. Only God's eudokia counts here. It's not shaped, it's not determined by the eudokia, any other eudokia, particularly the eudokia, the desire or intention of man. His will, again, remember, is mysterion, mystery. And as we could show without trying to argue carefully here, to say that the will is a mystery, we've already seen that as an indication of sovereignty, but what it means to say that it's a mystery is that it excludes human capacity. It excludes human competence, input from salvation. Again, 2 Timothy 1:9. There, Paul speaks of God's saving purpose as aideon, his very own, his own. And as such, it stands in opposition, as Paul says there, to all human accomplishment, to every human accomplishment. And therefore, it is a matter of charis, grace. Maybe I should have taken us back and had us read it again, but you'll see how the contrast there is not of works, but of His purposed grace from before the foundation of the world. So it the purpose stands in opposition to human accomplishment. Or another example, Romans 9:11. There, Paul is addressing the specific situation of Jacob and Esau and speaks of God's kat eklogein prothesis, His purpose according to election, His electing purpose. And he says then, applying that to the particular case of Jacob and Esau, that that electing purpose contemplates those twins and is put into effect, is effective prior to their birth. Prior, as Paul puts it, before they had done anything, good or bad, faith or anything else. Here particularly the notion of somehow that the divine determination is conditioned on the foresight of faith lying essentially outside the control of that plan is just entirely foreign. And again, we can remind ourselves of Romans 8:29. Whom He did foreknow, He also did predestinate. What Paul says there is that God's predestination flows from His foreknowledge. God's predestination flows from His foreknowledge. But what is His foreknowledge? His foreknowledge, as we have suggested earlier, and I've referred you to Professor Murray's handling of this verse in his commentary, His foreknowledge is not simply a bare precognition, but it is discriminating love, a discriminating love that does not arise from anything outside Himself. That discriminating love of foreknowledge is not prompted by anything lying outside of God. So we can say then, at this point, in connection with the footnote that we were making right at the end of point B, what we see now is that election is not only individual, but it is unconditional. It is not only individual, but unconditional. So we must not polarize corporate and individual, nor must we seek at the level of the individual to insist on what is conditional rather than what is unconditional. So the point all told, again quoting Professor Murray, God's saving will proceeds from the pure sovereignty and absolute determination of His counsel. Proceeds from the pure sovereignty and absolute determination of His counsel. A statement that Paul virtually could have written, does write. Next, let's consider now the goal of the plan. The goal of the plan. The goal of the plan in Ephesians 1 is clearly salvation. That soteriological goal is plain. We've already given some indication of that, and we can say especially that centers in verse 7. Redemption through His blood, the forgiveness of our transgressions according to the richness of His grace. Now, specifically here, we can note that the goal of predestination, we've already done this, so we'll do it again from a different angle. The goal of predestination is adoption, predestined for adoption. And that expressed in other terms, correlatively, the goal of election or choice, the goal of predestination is adoption, the goal of election before the foundation of the world is holy and blameless. Holy and blameless. By the way, just on the accuracy here, I think you want to punctuate after the autu and connect in agape with proorisos, so that the election, having predestined in love, rather than connecting the love with what precedes the holy and blameless. That would be possible, but I think less likely. So, we can connect, we see the parallel here, election and being holy and blameless before Him, God. Turn again to Romans 8:29, where what we see as here in this passage as correlatives, parallel, in Romans 8:29, the correlatives are expressed in a more interwoven fashion. Paul says, whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformable to the image of his Son, so that he might be the firstborn among many brothers. Here you see Paul says that the goal of predestination is conformity to the likeness of Christ as God's Son. In other words, that's the holiness of Ephesians 1:4. But then the further goal of the predestination is that Christ might be firstborn among many brothers. And that brings out then the adoption of Ephesians 1:5. And we might also notice, just going on to verse 30, since you have the passage open there, the culmination of the chain that Paul develops here, what has been referred to as the golden chain that begins in eternity and ends there. The goal that begins with predestination ends in eternity with the culmination of sanctification in what Paul refers to here as glorification. Also, we do well to remember here that in 2 Timothy 1:9 passage, turn there again, 2 Timothy 1:9, this factor is also present. The calling of God that Paul mentions at the beginning of verse 9, that calling of God rooted in his eternal purpose that we've been talking about all along, that calling is specifically a holy calling, who has saved us and called us with a holy calling. Now, what does it mean to talk of a holy calling, to call the calling holy? I think the point here is not so much to qualify the nature of the calling as an act, but as the NIV, I think, has gotten the force here, it's a call to a holy life. Call to a holy life. Now, the point that comes into view here is one, well, I just ask you to consider this from your own experience. The point that I'm concerned for here is one that I think too frequently is missed, not appreciated. There's something here that we too easily lose sight of, as especially we reflect on the decree of God and matters related to predestination. And what comes into view here that we must not downplay, but must be sure always to underline, not only for others, but for ourselves, is that predestination may never be isolated from its goal. Predestination may not be detached from its goal as it comes into view here. And that goal, you see, is preeminently personal holiness. Predestination may not be detached from that goal of personal holiness. Now, certainly, this... why don't I just go on here and make this point and wrap it up, and then we can take a break there at that point. The sequence here may not be reversed. Holiness is the issue of election. It's the outcome of election. It'd be very perverse to try to read it the other way around, that election is somehow the outcome of holiness. And when I say that, we must keep in mind, when we say that holiness is the outcome of election, all that is included in holiness, all that is necessarily associated with holiness, is the outcome of election. And that includes faith. That includes faith. We cannot detach faith from election. Faith is the fruit of election and is not in any sense its basis. You see, the only way we can have, if I could put it this way, the only way we can have an Arminian view of faith, that is, faith as the one thing that I can do, the only way we can have such faith is to detach it from personal holiness. But that is just not biblical faith. As Paul, for instance, makes very clear in Galatians 5:6, justifying faith is faith working through love. At the same time, we have to let the other side, the other of the proverbial shoes drop here. Election that does not result in holy living, election that does not result in holy living is simply not election. Election not resulting in holiness is not election. We could perhaps put it this way to make a point. In salvation, in the matter of our salvation, while the forgiveness of sins, justification is tactically prior, strategically, holiness, sanctification is more ultimate. I'm trying to make a point playing on the distinction between tactics and strategy. That while there might be a certain tactical, did I do a wrong thing?